I'd like to present our speaker for tonight, Amy from Los Angeles. Give her a welcome.
Good evening. My name's Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, guys. I just want to say thank you to Dan, and I want to thank, kind of collectively, I'd like to thank Larry, Brian, and Rhett for guiding me in here. It was quite the deal. Larry had asked me to speak several months ago, and I guess he moved to Arizona. And then so when I was like, oh, okay, just nailing down the time, I'll be there, what's the time? He's like, you need to talk to Brian. I'm like, oh, hey, Brian. And anyways, long story short, then I get led to Rhett. So I want to thank this group for having me here in your meeting. I love this. I love Chula Vista. I love San Diego. You guys are such a sweet group. I want to say happy birthday to the birthday people. That is amazing. I love that we get to sing happy birthday like on a daily basis. It's so cool. And I also want to thank my friend Janie for coming out with me and my two sponsees, Jenny and Brittany. I mean, it is the true joy and the bright spot of my life is sponsoring and thinking that I'm trying to help. So I'm going to try to share with you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My sober date is 9/8/1997. My home group is the Bellflower Big Book Group, and that's over in Bellflower. We have our main meeting on Monday nights. It's 7:30 to 9. It's a speaker meeting, and if you ever find yourself out that way and you have nothing to do, we're at 7:30. You want to get there a lot earlier because we're a busy meeting, and the seats fill up quickly. And No, it just gets, actually they're trying to vote that down though, so that's kind of good, you know, like don't save seats, and so now it's like just, you know, people are just all covert about it, but my sponsor's Hilda Fontana, and for those things I'm truly grateful. You know, when I say that I'm an alcoholic, it tells me who I am, and that tells me where I need to be, which is with you, and it makes very simple the message that we have here, which is the language of the heart, and I'm grateful that due to strong sponsorship, I was taken through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to this day, I'm still under the guidance of strong sponsorship, and that means they don't always tell you what you want to hear. But as a direct result, I've been sober for some days and for 21 years, so I'm very grateful. The drive up here was really nice. It was just so, I love driving into your town. It's so dreamy, and the sunset was awesome. It was like this great, did you guys see that? Like that killer, just like gold streak, and Janie's like, you know, God, there's God just showing off. And my sponsee's like, my grandma used to tell me that that was God with his paintbrush, you know. And I just thought, so great. And the sponsee's relaxed. They were chatting in the back, and then they were napping. And I just thought, just, I mean, what a great way to spend the day. You know, I got up early, and Janie and I connected, and we went out and we ran some errands because we were going to do a pumpkin carving tonight because it's Miss Brittany's first set through the holidays. So you know how we do with people when they're new. We take them through those holidays that can be rather sketchy. And so we went and got some pumpkins and did the Target thing. And Janie's house is like the warm holiday house, and we all carved pumpkins. Some of us carved our fingers and ate a lot of candy and came to see you guys. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. You are in a most divine and special place. You are in a very special emotional and spiritual place, and I hope that you are out of good ideas. I hope that you're out of ideas, because I find it works a lot better when you don't know. You know, for me, that has been true. And to this day, it's still, the answer is still, okay. Okay, what did she mean? Okay, okay, you know. And I want to welcome you and tell you that this does get better. It gets weird. It gets hard. But you know what? It's outlined in the book in the solution. Me and Janie were talking about this today. You know, the solution is always the same. It doesn't sound like the solution. It's still like get a commitment, stack the chairs, reach your hand out, welcome the newcomer. You know, when someone says show up, be on time, be early, and be where you say you want to be. And so anyways, thank you for having me to your group. So anyways, I was born, and I think that was kind of where everything kind of kicked off, because I was born with alcoholism, and I don't know that. I probably needed a drink coming out of utero, and or in utero, rather, and I should have known better. My mom told me it took me 27 hours to be born. I think I knew what was going to come my way, and I was born to a perfectly natural family, you know, normal, loving family, but you couldn't have told me that idea. I mean, my parents are both Midwestern nice. My dad is from St. Louis, Missouri, and my mom is from Iowa. And And so they've, like, you know, I think if they got a parking ticket, that was a big issue. And I was raised being told, you know, you don't put your hands on people, you be a friend to have a friend, you don't steal, you don't lie. I was raised going to church. I knew right from wrong. I didn't come in here a sociopath or a psychopath that I know of. I might be the one in the book, but no. But I came in here knowing some good things, you know. But that is, you know, I was born, I'm an Irish Catholic family. It's me, and we're Irish twins. It was me, and 14 months later is my brother Kevin, and 14 or 16 months after him is my sister Malia. And we moved around a whole lot. You know, my dad's Army, I'm an Army brat, and, you know, we just kind of moved around a lot. We were in L.A., and me and my brother were born there, and then we moved to Hawaii, which is why my sister got the cool name, and eventually we moved to Arizona, and that does not make me an alcoholic. You know, I'm an alcoholic because I drink especially for the way that alcohol makes me feel. It makes everything feel okay, you know. I actually don't even like the taste of alcohol, which makes it all the more bizarre to me that I drink it all. And so anyways, I was raised in this really normal family, and my siblings, by comparison, were very normal kids. You know, they would say things like, "Let's go out and play," and I would be like, "No, that's just, you know, doing too much." And I just felt always like the Grinch that stole Christmas. You know how he had that big green, like, paw, and he'd just kind of be like, you know, just trying to crack the code. And I can tell you, some years later, sober, I'm still, you know, trying to crack the code, and it still doesn't work. And by contrast, they would go out and play and climb a tree and have fun, and they would come back and have dinner, and I just felt like I never got the memo. I felt like I was the only one that didn't get the memo on how to live life. Everyone else just seemed to just kind of get it. And I just seemed so, I felt just so uncomfortable in life. I felt so just, yeah, now it's irritable, restless, and discontent. But at the time, it was just like, just uncomfortable. And I had trippy little hobbies. I collected coins and stamps and rocks. And at one point, I had this little tent in our little attic, and I would be under there, like, polishing rocks and organizing my stamps and my coins. And I was just a weird little uncomfortable kid. So, like I said, I had a family and friends that loved me, and I tell you that because, you know, it's funny, we all wind up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never saw my folks drink. Nobody drank in my family. My uncle, I have two of them, I think that they probably belong with us, one of his own admission as an alcoholic, and that was it. That was all. I mean, if they drank, I don't really notice it. I wasn't, no one beat me. Hands were not put on me. I was raised upper middle class. I had everything you could possibly want for, and I was just this entitled little brat. You know, it was never enough, it was never good enough, and I was convinced that I was adopted, and my sister and brother are towheads, and my parents have brown hair, so I just always was kind of separate from the whole. I just didn't feel like I fit in, and I didn't feel like I was loved, and you couldn't have told me. But I have alcoholism. I don't know that I have a spiritual malady. I didn't know that till I would come to you guys, and I've come to understand that over the years, that is still very present. That's alcoholism. And this is not my first rodeo, so if this is not your first rodeo, you can just stop when you plan to quit digging. And this has been a trip. Anyway, so my family, I love my parents today, and I know them to be good people today, but at the time I have alcoholism. I'm not seeking a spiritual solution, and so my folks got divorced when I was about 8 years old, and that was the single most traumatic thing happening in my suburban life. And I just remember thinking all my ideas of, of authority just shattered to the ground, my ideas of religion and raising family and getting married. And there it went, just like, you know, and there went my little resentment toward authority. If you're not going to do what you say, then I'm not going to do what you ask. You know, and isn't that interesting that here we are in Alcoholics Anonymous and we lead by example? You know, some of the loudest suggestions I've received are the examples that the women before me have had, that they talk right, they dress right, they show up where they're at, they're kind, they're loving and tolerant. And these are the messages I got first before I started being taken through the steps. Because if you guys hadn't welcomed me into the rooms and extended your hand and showed me where the coffee was, I don't know that this alcoholic would be here with you tonight. So anyways, they got divorced, and I just remember feeling devastated, and there went my little, you know, one-finger peace sign to the world, and, right, and that's just kind of how it started. I just didn't, that was just devastating to me, so my life was pretty normal. I went to school as a good student. I ran track and field. I always wanted to go to the Olympics in sports, and that's just what I did. I grew up in Arizona. There's not a whole lot to do there, so I ran, and I would do things. And we moved to Montana for a stint, and that's when I ice skated and skied, and I still ran and did synchronized swimming, and that's what I like to do. Is I like to get really good grades, and I like to excel so that I'm under the radar. So you're busy, and I'll do a lot of this. Well, look at that person, and look at this kid, and I just kind of skate under the radar. And I'm 8 years old, and around that time, and I'm an angry little kid, and I'm disappointed. What a shocker, right? Because we have expectations. And we go to my aunt and uncle, my godmother's place in Tucson, Arizona, and there's not a whole lot to do in Tucson either, and I'm an angry little alcoholic at that time, budding and blooming right along. And my uncle offers me, my uncle says if I wash his car that he will give me a Bud Tall and a silver dollar, and I just think that is so cool, and I start washing his car and polishing the hubcaps, and he gives me a silver dollar and a Bud Tall, and I crack that back, and I drink it faster than probably an 8-year-old should, and I remember two ideas that hit me like it happened 5 seconds ago, and that is I want to do that again. And I want to be a prostitute. And I don't know about you guys, but that just seemed like a natural thought. That just, I mean, you're not really questioning your thoughts when you're at that age, and you're not really going, hey, did you have a beer and think that you wanted to do blah, blah? I don't even know how I knew that word. I don't even know how I knew a lot of things. I was doing a lot of weird stuff, and I'm like, my parents don't act that way, so I don't know where I got that. My friends, I've had three of them for 40 years, and they don't act that way. So I'm like, I was really not running with the bad kids till much later, and I was the bad kid. And so I didn't go off and start skipping down the road of happy drinking right away. It's very difficult to hustle your game in front of a liquor store when you're 8 years old, but what that kind of looked like to me is there's always someone's older brother, older sister, you know, and they're willing to get you alcohol. Maybe someone's a thief. Maybe it's me, and you would steal it and walk out. And but at the time, you know, it was just easier to get drugs. People call them outside issues. I just call them drugs. And just to be really clear, I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm an alcoholic, first and last, because the first thing I picked up was alcohol. The last thing I set down was alcohol. It is everything to me. And anything in the middle, stripping, drugs, hospitals, jails, just where my alcoholism allows me to go. It's funny, when I'm sober, I don't start romancing those ideas to do that in my sobriety. But it was easier to get my little paws on drugs. You know, I remember going to the park and just taking like Black Beauties and cross tops and this and that and reds. And I didn't even question, all Jimi Hendrix style, like, I didn't even question, like, how does that make you feel? It was just, if I am here, I want to be over there. It has been a theme my whole life. If you have that, I not only want what I have, but I also want what you have. And it's got to be better, because I'm constantly, I don't know at the time, but I'm constantly trying to change the way I feel by the stuff that I accrue. And separate from Alcoholics Anonymous and God and strong sponsorship and working with others, I'm that same person today. You know, I'd love to tell you that you just get better if you're new. I can tell you that things, you respond better to the outside world because you learn some things in here, and your tool belt, just, you get all these tools from strong sponsorship and the fellowship around you. And so I was doing these things in the park, and we got a hold of alcohol. And so just a little snippet of kind of how I, like I said, as a good student, I was placed in honors classes in high school, and I'm an angry little child, you know. My mom says to me, she's like, you were the nicest little baby, the happiest little baby. You could have just been in a paper bag and played with your toes, and you were such a happy little baby, always happy. She's like, and something changed in you when we got a divorce and we separated. You started storming in and out of the rooms and slamming doors, and we'd say, do you want to talk? And I'd be all, no, and I'd, you know, storm in and out of the rooms. And so I'm becoming already difficult, you know, but I'm an alcoholic, and I'm probably not really in what worked for me, which is alcohol worked for me for a really, really long time until it didn't, and I didn't want to pay the piper anymore. And so I'm starting to hang out with friends, and we're doing things like going to parties. And I, you know, I think about it now, and I think, you know, it just started so simply. It's like just to go to a party with friends, you know. And like I said, I had really cool and nice friends, and we go to these parties, and they were called keggers. And for some of you, you might have to Google what that is, and some of us know, but maybe some of you might have to Google it, the younger ones. And that's when someone's parents go out of town, and someone gets a keg, and that is like a little round metal keg, and usually it's filled with spirits and beer, and you just said maybe they throw it in the pool to keep it cool, or maybe that's just me. And you go over that house and you just get tanked. And it started so simply. You know, I remember being at a party once with my little best friend, and I had ridden over on the handlebars of her bicycle because that's how we did it. And we get over there, and she's having a drink, and it seems to me others are having a drink, and I'm sitting on top of the keg, and I'm already wondering if there's going to be enough alcohol for everybody. And I'm a territorial little alcoholic, and I know my primary purpose, so I'm on top of the keg, and nothing seemed weird to me. But when I had 60 days this time, my best friend Debbie, she says to me, "Dude, do you remember that one time when you were sitting on top of the keg and you had two beers?" This to me sums up alcoholism in a nutshell. She says, you had two beers and all of a sudden it was like you were going to offer these guys sexual favors. And I was like, I was kind of a shy kid, you know, because I'm so self-consumed and self-obsessed and self-absorbed and riddled with selfish fear, you know. And I was like, oh, my God. And then what did I do? She's like, well, I said, let's go. And I'm like, and then what did I do? She's like, you came with me. And I was so grateful for that because later on I would become a violent drunk. And I was so grateful that I didn't really expose that to my friend. And because I love my friends dearly. Like I said, I've got friends I've known for decades. And that's just kind of how I drank. I remember one of my first serious drunks, I started blacking out at a pretty early age. I got a hold of this super big gulp cup, and we would sometimes pilfer from, like, my friend's parents, you know, whatever bar or the cupboard where all the alcohol was, and I put in, like, vodka and gin and tequila and rum, and it was nasty, and I would be sipping on that, and maybe this much Diet Coke, because that's important. And I'd be sipping on that, and I remember the world just like spinning, and not in a good way. And I tell my friends, hey, let's go hike this mountain. I think it was like Camelback Mountain, and I have these like Conan the Barbarian sandals on that were very cool in my day. And basically they have no traction, and I go climbing and scampering up this mountain, and I lose my footing, and I go falling down the mountain. I don't remember anything other than kind of like, oh, and going down the mountain. And next thing I remember is like this knock on the door, and it's my dad like trying to wake me up. Time to get up for school. And my heart is just like racing like it would when I drank too much the night before, or I'd black out, and it would just race like I was coming out of this coma kind of. And I go to get up, and I like my arms and my legs are just stuck to the sheets in blood. You know, and there started my dual life. There started my Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm stripping that bed, and I'm starting to stash those sheets under my bed. At the time, I had this little room. They built this room, go figure, built away from the house. Because I'm a simple little child, and they have me out in this, like, where the carport is at, really. So it was kind of easy to have my little dual life out here, and I'm peeling myself off my sheets and stashing those sheets. And at the time, my dad was remarried to my stepmom, and she had three sons. And so my mother was one of the types that was, like, from the 60s. She'd play guitar on a dude ranch and go missing for a year. And Bonnie was, like, this triple A mom, like, lick your lips for the Christmas pictures. Lick your lips. So I just remember being, this has got to be a joke, you know? And I went from like the 60s parents that didn't really care about rules to the hyper-vigilant 35 rules on the refrigerator that none of us six kids took seriously. But my point is I had to do a lot of work to get past those three kids, my brother, my sister, that stepmom, my father. It was tough work. You know, I sometimes reflect back on that. I'm like, being a little alcoholic, though the rewards are great because it makes you guys okay and it levels the playing field, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to do the planning, to get the stuff that we need, to get the alcohol that we need, to do what we do and then do it all over again tomorrow. You know, and I also want to share with you that if you are new, Alcoholics Anonymous works really well. It just works a lot slower than the alcohol. And I know that if I went and picked up a drink right now, it would do exactly what it's supposed to do for me. But I would lose everything that is worth having to me. And so anyways, that's kind of how it was when it was working for me. You know, I was a good little student, and I went to high school, and I showed up so that I couldn't really be, you know, pinpointed or caught for anything. And I graduated from high school early, and I went off to Berkeley, and that's where it really just got bad. It really just got bad. I was a good little student, so academically I did well. I had a syllabus, which to me meant I really didn't, class was optional. And I almost lose track of time here. So anyways, I would go to school, and I started dancing at night, exotic dancing, and I was telling my family I'm just expressing myself creatively and artistically, and I'm going and turning in papers. And I remember this one time, it just kind of sticks in my mind. You know, the funny things you just can't get rid of. I sometimes have nightmares about not finishing exams. And there was this one time that I parked in the garage and it was time for a midterm or a final. And I remember thinking, I was so tired because I was partying so much. I'm like, I'm just going to shut my eyes. And I woke up like hours later and my heart is like, I'm like, oh my God. And I call the teacher and they let me retake the test. But that's kind of where my alcoholism took me. And that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing, it just got worse. You know, I'd be dancing at night and partying at night and hanging with all these shady people. And there were guns involved in places where a young lady should never be. And I paid those consequences too. And that is just me and my cups. You know, that isn't necessarily them taking advantage of me. I didn't need to be there from the gate. And then by day, I would be in class and doing my papers and doing all this stuff, but it just got really, really hard to maintain that. And at this point, my family's kind of not in my life. They're staying away, but that worked for me. And when you have a family and you have friends that love you like my family did, you got to work really hard to push them away. Because when you want to drink like I drank, for example, like my friends are good people, so when I would drink and we'd be drinking together, they would say crazy things like, well, dude, I got to get up early tomorrow to do chores. And I'd be like, what? Or they'd say something like, you know, I got to get home. I'm tired. Or what about this one? I'm feeling a little woozy. He's like, this is where it just starts. And so all that message is to me is just don't drink with those people. And so I immediately am seeking lower companionship. I wasn't much for bars because they too would also spot and say, we're going to cut you off. So if I went to a bar, it was usually to get warmed up and shoot some stick because I loved to shoot pool when I was in college and hustle for a little bit. And I'd start up and I'd get warmed up there. But about 1:30, I had to leave and go to the liquor store and had to get a big bottle of alcohol and booze or a 24-pack of beer and go home alone because that's where the drinking would start. You know, and it's like, I love what Bill Cleveland says when he speaks and he says that, you know, I end up in my living room naked and alone. It's party a la Uno. And that's how my drinking ended up. We were just talking about it on the way in that it started really fancy. You know, I'd start with, you know, whiskey 7 and 7, shoot and pull. And then I'd be drinking a beer just to take it easy for a little bit. And then I'd be drinking, you know, White Russians when the pool game was just getting serious and Frangelico at the end. But what happened is that slowly just kind of progressed into a bottle of Cisco and you know, everything else. And I'm hanging out with harder people and getting into more dangerous predicaments. And I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 19 years old. I don't know how I heard about you guys. I really don't. I wish I could remember that. But I started happening in the rooms in the Bay Area, and I would go into candlelight meetings, and I would sit there, and I would just kind of shake, and you guys looked pretty serious. You guys were smiling and laughing, and the coffee was on, the sweets were out, and I just figured you guys were on something. Like, nothing was funny to me when I came to you guys, but it seemed to me that you guys had something here. I wasn't sure if it was, like, a substance or alcohol. I was pretty certain it was in the coffee, but I came here, and that seed was planted really early, and I would continue coming here. You guys seemed to be really serious about commitments and following and giving me numbers and giving me hugs and let's hold hands, and I just remember thinking, these people are, they want me. You know what I mean? And I thought, wow, I was such a vision for you. I might have been 96 pounds that first time, and you guys didn't want anything from me. And my last home group was this meeting. It was like half smoking, half not back in the day. And they fought over washing the actual real mugs, not styrofoam. And I was like, wow, they're really serious about taking out the trash and washing the mugs and like tackling each other to take commitments. And I thought, this is crazy, you know. But it was so exciting. And I thought smoking on half and not smoking on the other half, because I used to smoke like a fiend. And I would sit there and smoke and judge, you know how we do when we're really new and healthy. And I would stay there for a stint of time. I got a sponsor, and he told me, I'm going to get you a book. And I said, I don't need a book, a big book. And I'm like, I don't need a big book. I went to college. I have plenty of books. And just didn't get it. Just did not get it. And he scampers on up. He doesn't seem to listen to anything I'm saying. He gets me a book. And that first sponsor I had, he was just completely blown out gay. And he's like, sweetie, I'm going to go get you a book. And he comes on back. And because I was so ashamed and I was so guilty and I just felt like this big and I could really only look at your feet, and I'm going to candlelight meetings because I don't want you to look in my eyes, because I'm pretty certain you can see where I've been and how I've lived as a woman. You know, I'm horrified that you're going to look right through me. And I'm pretty certain that that's going to convict me of where I've been. And I don't really want to look at that much more, because when you're not drinking and you're an alcoholic, for me, when I sobered up, I was pretty just like, everyone's going to know who I am, and then you're going to throw me out, right? And he, it didn't seem he listened to me at all. He went up and got the 12 and 12 and he got me a big book and he handed it to me and said, write my date in there in ink. And off we went on the little march to stay sober. And he took me through those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was perfect for me because that shame and that guilt, that looking me in the eyes, he was so self-absorbed and like, sweetie, I just love your bracelets and your skirts and keep on reading your step to me. But he didn't really look me in the eyes. So I could comfortably go through my steps. And yet he was always present. And I remember he said to me, he's like, repeat after me. I may be special, but I'm not it. And I remember thinking, I am so it. And I blew up and I'm like, totally it. And I walked home from our step work that we were doing. And the sad thing is I believe that, you know. And so we did the deal and I stuck around for about 6.5 years, 5.5 years of that. I was working a program and I was dry for a year and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. That is painful, painful, painful. I remember I'd get a bill and I had money and I'd think, what do I do with this? And my mom at the time was staying with me because she didn't really feel like being a nurse anymore or something. And she's hanging out with me and saying things like, you should really go back to those meetings. And I'm all, stay out of it, you know, and just a mess, just a mess. And it just seemed like that just was like crawling through molasses to get to even the next hour and the next day. And just spiritually just dying, and I don't know, you know. And what had happened was I had 5 sponsees, and I was going to meetings on a regular basis, and I just slowly started backing away. I'm never worried about the people that are like, you know, I hate meetings, I don't want to be sober, because everyone can gather around that. It's the people that start backing away really slow, like suddenly they don't have time for fellowship. It goes a little something like this. Like they get a job, their life cleans up, and all of a sudden I'm a little busy. I got to get up early for work tomorrow. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. Maybe you didn't have a life. I didn't have a life when I got here. Alcoholics Anonymous, everything in my life worth having is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every good thing that I have inside of me, integrity, honesty, dignity, showing up, any kind of love and tolerance, I learned right here. I learned trust. I made my biggest mistakes here, but I've grown up here. I came to you a broken girl, and I grew up here. You know, you guys told me, just sit and take your seat. You don't need to do anything new, just follow the herd. And that's what I did. And I pieced together a little bit of time and I stopped doing the things we did. I started backing away. And lo and behold, I found myself in that situation where my grandfather was very sick and I'm very dramatic and I think he's dying. And we're all in this little like hotel place. And there's like a jacuzzi and me and my cousins are in the jacuzzi and they're like, come on over to the table, you guys. And I scamper on over there. I wasn't thinking about drinking. I didn't want to drink. It was nowhere on my mind. And we sit at the table. And my uncle says, have a drink. My other uncle. I don't know what it is with me and uncles. And it's an Irish family. I guess we really did drink. I just didn't. And he says, have a drink. And I said, I don't drink, Uncle Kevin. I don't drink. And he's like, have a drink. And I'm like, I don't drink for a half an hour. I'm in AA. I'm sober. I don't drink. But I'm like gripping. And there were no cell phones at the time, I don't think. And I didn't have any numbers. And I wasn't working with a sponsor. And I wasn't staying accountable. I was out just running roughshod over the whole world. And I'm just gripping. Right? I'm just gripping, sitting around feeling good, going to church and talking to people. Doesn't work for an alcoholic of my type. I need to be with you guys. And suddenly, right, one word in a sentence changes everything. He said to me, it's happy hour. It's 2 for 1. And just like that, I was like, 2 margaritas on the rocks, hold the salt. Like that, like it was nothing. I was like, where'd those words come from? And that cocktail waitress turned on her heel and walked away. And I remember like my heart just like, what have you done? What have you done? Just terrified. But it was coupled with like pride of I was not going to be wrong, so I wouldn't stop her. And they brought back those margaritas, and I drank those things back like it was nothing, you know. And I went back to the hospital, and my mom's like, have you been drinking? I'm like, I really just had a problem with drugs. And then I go back to my little life the way that it was. I had 6 months in me, and that was it. And now I'm hiding alcohol from myself, and at the time I lived alone. You know, and that's just what happened. This time my family intervened on me. They weren't playing games. They said things like, we love you and we don't want to see you die. And I just remember thinking, die? I'm just trying to have a good time. I'm kind of hoping you guys will leave. I got some stuff stashed in my Encyclopedia Britannicas, and I've got alcohol in my freezer, and they just need to go. So I'm just ripping their eyes out, taking their inventory and hurting them, shooting below the belt. Remember the time you did this, and you guys never, blah, blah. And they're crying, and one by one, they're leaving. And there I am with my stepbrother, Anton, and my best friend, Debbie. And they just sat there. I remember they wouldn't leave. They sat there and they had their hand like around my leg. Like my best friend had her hand around my leg. And she since told me like, I could put my entire hand around your leg. You were so thin. And she said, you know, dude, please, give this a try. They were talking about rehab. I'd been to jails and I'd been to psych wards. I don't know anything about rehab. In hindsight, having done the work, I know I was terrified. I didn't know what a rehab was. I had no idea what that looked like. I'm terrified. And I'm like, I'm not going in there. And, you know, and she's like, it's like a vacation. And I was like, vacation? Alcohol, sobriety is not a vacation. If anyone's told you that, they're lying. But if you're in here and you're considering that there's a choice between jail, institutions, a drunken, you know, horrible death, or a spiritual way of life, I just did your first step for you. You know, it shouldn't have to be something you think about. And yet I had to think about it. And so they left me there. You know, they left me there. They took off, and I'm now a happy little alcoholic, and I'm playing Nina Simone and feeling sorry for myself. And in the spirit of steps 1, 2, and 3, I know that you take them and you take them in order and you take them with a sponsor, but I'm sitting in this ridiculous beach chair, and it seemed to me, and I'm drinking. I still have that same silly, super big gulp. I guess it was a tradition. I've got these dark sunglasses on, and neighbors are coming by like, hey, good morning, how you doing? They got their coffee. They're all sparkly and shiny. They take off, and they come back with their dry cleaning, and they're like, hey, how you doing? They got their lunch and everything. They're going back up in their apartment, and then they come down, and it's twilight, and they're going to dinner, and same thing, and this went on for about 5 or 7 days. And it seemed to me, it occurred to me, and this is like, I think it was like 5 days after the intervention, I had some time to think about it. And it seemed to me that the gig was up. It was never gonna get better than this. This was it. This was my moment. This was my moment. I believe sobriety is a gift. I believe it is a window. It is a grace from God. And what you do with it is your gift back. And then we get to give it back if we're so lucky to stay here. But it is a window. I believe it is very narrow, and you slip through it. There are no guarantees that I can stay if I go back out again. And so I called up my dad, and I said, I'm going to go in, and, you know, you can take care of the affairs here. He said, call me when you're there. And I have my friend Gina B drive me to rehab, and I don't know what that looks like. And I'm just, well, if they don't let me smoke and there's no caffeine in the coffee, I'm out of there. And I'm talking like I've got choices. And, you know, and it's just, we're like delusional, just complete, like missing the memo. And I'm going down to Orange County, which I usually would only drive through. And we get there to this rehab, and I'm terrified looking back, but I just thought I had things to do, and how rude is she to just drop me off at this place? And I'm like, well, there's a McDonald's over there, and I'm smoking, and I don't want to get out of the car, and can't we just get some French fries? And I'm just putting it off and putting off and putting it off. And I'm like, just French fries? She's like, dude, get out of the car. Finally, she pops the trunk, and she takes out my suitcase with all the clothes I own, which I probably never wore again, in my Nina Simone CD. She, like, walks it up to the doorway of the rehab and kicks it over the foyer, and she's like, she's all yours. And I got to say, that's a bottom. That was a new bottom. You know, she was one of my biggest enablers in many ways. And she's no longer with us in my ninth month of sobriety this time around. She passed away. She had a heart problem. And so one of my angels is higher up now and has rings. Probably burned her out myself. But I got into that rehab, and it was wonderful. There was a house of 50 of us. And right away, there was like this little blonde that came up. And she's like, you want to do 90 days with me? And I'm like, I'm not staying here 90 days. Your mom works here, and blah, blah. Already looking for the differences. And she said, well, what about 30? And I said, okay, 30. And we did 30, and then 60, and then 60, and 90, and 90, and 6 months, and just taking cakes one by one. I got a sponsor in my second week, and I'm taking the steps. I don't even know what she's talking about. I remember everything sounded a little bit like it was another language, you know, like I felt like people were telling me things like stand on your head upside down, stand on your head and drink water. But in truth, they were probably, but when you're selfish as me, it was probably only one thing, like go stack a chair. You know, but it's too much for a selfish alcoholic of my type. And my sponsor took me through steps 1 through 12, and I worked with her for a period of time, and then I got a different sponsor, Gina B, and we trudged together this road, and she just gave of her time for fun and for free, and she took me to meetings, and she showed me to you, and I started sponsoring when I had about a year, when I finished my steps, and that's where all the okays and the feeling of being told what to do, and now you get a little experience, so when they say something, you just know it's a choice. Like, if I go the other direction from my sponsor, I know I'm probably going to pay the price. When I was new, it was just like, well, I'm just reinventing the wheel, and I start sponsoring, and that's where everything you guys taught me made sense. And So what I do is I don't do anything. I don't change anything. If it works, you know, if it ain't broke, I don't fix it. I go to 4 meetings a week. I have a home group. I have commitments. And 3 of my meetings, if I'm asked to do something for AA, I do that thing. And I just do the best I can. I'm not perfect. I have a series of issues, it seems. But, you know, one thing I've done, you know, one thing I have done is I haven't picked up. I haven't felt it necessary to pick up. And that sponsor passed away. And to back it up really quick, Larry, he gave up his date. He got very sick and he didn't feel it necessary to give his date, you know, keep his date. And my only thinking, because I'm so selfish, was, well, he never told me. And those you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous said things to me like, what, you know, you can't forgive him his humanness, or would it have been different if he had told you? And I just was backing out of the rooms already with that resentment, you know, that big God-sized resentment. And when Gina passed away, I was able to stick around, and it devastated me. And I can tell you this, you can sit through anything. You can sit through anything. Is it going to hurt? Yes. Are you going to feel lonesome? Yes. But if you want to do it alone, that will be your choice. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we were just talking about how we always have something to do. You know, there's always something to do on the weekends. And if you just reach out your hand and you just say, hey, can you help me? There's probably everyone here would do that for you. And that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm doing things that make no sense to me. You guys have told me things that make no sense to me. And as a direct result, I've had a life beyond my wildest dreams. And so I'm still sponsored. And my sponsor has me on a new inventory. And, I'm being a good little sponsee and procrastinating. But, you know, I am so grateful that I am sober and that I get to be with you. And I'm so grateful that you guys had me here and have patiently listened to me in your house. So I just want to thank each and every one of you for having me here. And happy holidays to all of you. So thanks. Yay.